Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting extravaganza of an episode of The Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulous, the fluoridated, the irradiated. It's just so beautiful, and that is the reason why we get really large quantities of tourist dollars. In fact, even New Zealanders aren't under the impression that our country, more or less, has its largest industry being tourism. You didn't know that, did you, New Zealanders? You thought we produced milk products and food and so on and so forth and stuff that actually matters, that allows us to be independent. Sorry to burst that bubble, but we're completely dependent on everybody else coming to New Zealand. So hopefully the Vinnie Eastwood Show will drag people here in droves so that they can enjoy the high rad levels. My very special guest is Kevin P. Lawton. The crowdfundingrevolution.com is his website, and he's a bit of an author. Now, this is a subject very, very near and dear to me hearts, as every single one of you regular subscribers and donors would know. This show is funded by you. And now we're going to interview an author of a book on the subject. I'm quite excited. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Vinnie, man, it's great to be here with you. I've listened to a lot of your stuff, and I totally enjoyed it, man.
I believe you had some form of quip or Buckminster Fuller quote to start off the episode here.
I'd love to, man. I just like to tell everybody that Buckminster Fuller, I think, probably had the best activist mind on earth, and he really gave us some good tidbits, some real pearls of wisdom. And so here's one of my favorites from him. If you want to teach people a new way of thinking, don't bother trying to teach them. Instead, give them a tool, the use of which will lead to new ways of thinking. R.I.P. my good friend. He had a lot of other great quotes and a lot of fantastic engineering as well that he left us with. But I think that we'd be wise to, you know, kind of rediscover the man.
Did you ever meet him?
No, I hadn't. Yeah, I think he died in something like, you know, 1983 or so.
Oh, well, that was a year before I was even born, son.
Well, we won't talk about me, but.
Okay, let's keep that on the down low.
Yeah.
Kevin, please tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
All right. Well, I mean, like most people, I was born into an insane asylum and then put through an educational concentration camp known as school when I was younger. And like a lot of creative minds kind of, you know, realized early on that wasn't something that made a lot of sense to me, you know, being taught by people, these imposters proposing to be teachers and whatnot. So I guess I was kind of a independent thinker and an autodidactic type of person most of my life. And then I went on to go get what they call an honest job, I guess. My first job was MIT Lincoln Laboratory, worked on a bunch of, I guess you could say, DOD kind of projects. And then, you know, that was a nice place to work, but I had an entrepreneurial mind and went off to start off my first startup company. That was kind of a techie thing, but essentially I modeled the whole PC and software, and that software was done in a sort of an open source model. It was available on the internet, and that was used to essentially research and develop a lot of the virtualization projects out there, VMware and Xen and all these guys. That's one of the key technologies these days in Amazon Cloud, it turns out. So while they got the credit, it's always the case there was somebody before them. And in this case, that would probably be me. And so I went off to do a startup doing that. And fortunately, I had sold the company I was working in that did that and made it completely open source, and then went on to work for a whole slew of other startup companies, some of them venture-backed. Actually, in aggregate, probably some of the companies I worked on have taken over probably about $250 million total in venture finance. Been at early startups in residence at a couple of venture firms and studied venture capital and then, you know, and some economics and finance and capital markets and all kinds of stuff. And along that process, especially being an independent thinker, it really, you know, the whole system really abraded me and occurred to me that, boy, this system is broken, man. This doesn't make any sense at all. This isn't, you know, funded by people who should be funding it. The wrong companies are getting funded. The way people have to approach people to get funding is wrong. The whole bit was broken. So I started blogging, and that blogging sort of converged on a series of presentations that I put on SlideShare.net called The New Face of Venture Capital, Parts 1 through 3. And sort of the end result of that, the conclusion is, you know, the last slide was a lot about crowdfunding and all the detriments of the current system essentially were solved or resolved by, you know, at least an advanced form of crowdfunding, a little bit farther than we are now. But that really got me thinking. And so I started exploring, well, you know, why don't we have crowdfunding platforms instead of going to angels and then later venture capitalists? So I started diving into some, you know, the nasties of SEC regulations and, you know, talking to as many people as I could. And it became clear that the answer is because it's absolutely suppressed. The entire system is just baked to keep people who are entrenched in the system entrenched and people who aren't out. You know, and that dates, in the U.S.-centric view anyway, that dates back to 1933, the Securities Act and 34 Exchange Act, where they essentially created I call it financial apartheid system in the United States, and many of the other countries adopted similar things in the similar time frame. Essentially, it's sort of a template. So you can see that template happen in other countries.
More or less, it's a legal framework that doesn't sound totally tyrannical to people looking at it, but it actually is and works quite well in its fashion and its design.
Absolutely, man. I mean, they literally, when I say apartheid, I'm not really kidding, because they literally classify people into two buckets. There's an accredited and non-accredited. And that sounds like you took a degree or some kind of training or what have you. But the truth is, accredited just means someone with enough wealth. That's it. And then there's people without it, and they're non-accredited, or the, you know, proletariat class, essentially. And you know, and then they went even further, essentially, along the way, and they made sure that financial advisors could only recommend listed stocks, which to us really means public stocks. So there you go, right? You can't even have a financial advisor who's very savvy and early phase investing, essentially going out to the general public and saying, hey, look, here's a local startup company. You know, it's a organic bakery or something, or a nice little mini farmstead. You know, they can't even... if they wanted to, they could not recommend it to you. So they really boxed out people from talking to other people. I mean, it's really nothing more than, in the U.S., a First Amendment obliteration, essentially. They just disabled people's ability to reach out to their own kind and you know, look for financing from people who would actually maybe even live next door, for example, you know, God forbid. So it really is an apartheid system, and it's worked really well for the intended consequence, which seems to be shutting out people. So I started, you know, blogging a lot and talking to people and researching, and then hooked up with a guy who was doing, you know, he's working on his PhD, and he was really concentrating on crowdfunding. And he saw some of my work online and said, hey, you know, I'm writing this book. Man, some of your thinking is fantastic. Let's write this book together. So I ended up being an accidental author and, you know, researching and talking and got to know as many people as I could. And oddly enough, the people at the Office of Science and Technology at the White House heard about crowdfunding and, hey, this might be something for the economy, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And ended up doing a conference call with them about, you know, the whole kind of context of crowdfunding and who would be the next few people to talk with. And then kind of hooked up in the sidelines with some people who were advocating for, you know, getting congressional hearings. And, you know, just I was really always on the sideline, but a lot of the kind of intellectual thinkings that I put on the table in the book, the blog, and otherwise ended up in some of the written testimony. And to make a long story short, they had a really good impact in the House with McHenry's bill, which was just fantastic. This really light touch just really opened the doors without a lot of red tape. And then it got passed to the Senate and dirtied up as much as you could imagine, and then got passed as part of a six-pack of things in the Job Act. Legalization of crowdfunding, not Kickstarter style for perks and whatnot, but for security, so equity, debt, revenue share, and these kinds of things. And then, you know, they did the classic thing after getting a lot of votes from passing that, which is they passed it off the SEC to, you know, further generate some more red tape pile that no one can work through. And then promised to do it within a year, and now it's a couple of years, and we're still waiting. Still waiting for the finalization for a law that we have where people still, at least the common people, can't use crowdfunding in a meaningful way. However, one of the other pieces was an extension of crowdfunding for accredited investors like angels and whatnot, and they finalized on that, and that's working now. So I guess they have to work harder to protect the people, in air quotes, of course. And so that's where we're at.
Are you telling me that you've actually helped to put legislation that is now in effect in the United States?
I've been involved in it. I don't think I want to get too much further than that much involvement. At one point, they were actually asked, the friends who did, you know, they went in front of Congress. They were wondering if I wanted to go for the next round. And I said, you know, the problem is that I have this problem that I tell the truth, and I'm not sure that's the guy you want testifying.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, you probably would have been kicked out of the House or held in contempt or something. This man's telling the truth. Put him in jail.
Yeah, we're all being suppressed. Leave the building.
Yeah. You know, that's un-American. Fight for freedom. What is he doing about? We have no history of that.
Yeah. However, the great news out of this whole thing is it did sort of spread. The idea spreads, you know, lighting fires in the minds of men, I suppose. But, you know, other countries did their own. My co-author had his fingerprints in the Italian version of it, and that's kind of went through a little bit quicker. And maybe it's not the perfect bill either, but at least that, you know, that kind of lit a fire there, and it got other people thinking in different countries about, geez, you know, maybe we should let regular people be involved in creating companies, as radical as that is. And so the idea is out there, and it's available. And frankly, any country that enables it and really, really puts, you know, emphasis on allowing to happen rather than adding red tape, I think is going to have a phenomenal economic impact from it.
Can you explain and define exactly what crowdfunding is and also what the term open source means?
Sure. Let's start with open source. So I'm old enough, it turns out, to have been, you know, involved in open source fairly early. So, for example,
hey, so is the Heinz Corporation. They know how to open source.
Yeah, we'll just skate right past that comment. But so, you know, in the 80s, I got involved in this idea of open source, which is just really collaborative software creation. And what happened is I went to school. I went to college at just the right time when the internet was really coming online, and you know, we could have these things, these radical things called email, and you know, massive online player games and stuff like that going on. But at any rate, what had happened was the internet really opened up the ability for people between schools, and then even people outside of schools, to start collaborating on creating software, just because they could, to be honest with you, you know. And it's sort of like any other collaborative environment where birds of a feather flock together, and people started creating games and tools, utilities, and all kinds of stuff together, and that sort of blossomed into this what you see now actually running on most of the servers in the world, or I should say, yeah, I would say majority of them are running Linux these days, which is a whole complex of software created in a collaborative environment, so literally on in every country, probably in every school. You know, every zip code almost is probably someone helping with open source on the earth. And so I got involved in that early, and I author of a couple projects there. And so that's kind of open source. And that's interesting because before we get to, you know, really in the crowdfunding, think open source set the stage for sort of a way of thinking and a way of existing that's a predecessor to a lot of the kind of new emerging models that we've got crowdfunding.
Can I interject?
Yeah,
because it seems that via your definition and explanation of what open source is, this is actually the model by which most in the conspiracy movement work together.
Yeah, absolutely. You're open sourcing truth, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're collaborating over something, and I guess you could even say so that what there's the collaborative part, and then there's the openness that, you know, a lot of them people in the truth movement are working in the open. I guess closed source, which would be the commercial software, the analog to your statement would be the, you know, the internet stooges that go out there and slam people. You know, anyone that has any kind of resonance of truth gets some kind of a troll comment, you know, about how their comments crap, or, you know, they don't like the way they look, or they have bad hair or something like that.
Oh, bro, the internet has bigger troll armies than the frickin' Lord of the Rings, bro.
No kidding, man. See, I think that's the mistake from the people with positive intent, because, see, I think we later we'll get into why I think that activism has been kind of lame and how you need to amp it up. But
oh, it's been compromised, to be sure, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's no reason why regular people can't be inverse trolls, right? So why not go out there and pretend to be a troll and then point people to a URL that's supposedly dispelling somebody's truth and then turns out to be even more information?
Mm. Hey, what's trolls backwards? Slot. Ladies?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If you're going out there and you're being slotty online, you have something to be proud about.
You're adding value, man. So, like, I think a lot of these things, things that we, you know, we sort of despise them, but on the other hand, a lot of the problem is really that people just haven't thought about turning it on its head, right? So, you know, in some ways, open source guys, they had kind of a chip off their shoulder against some of the controlled software and commercial ware, and you know, they went out and they just made their own software. So they just kind of did it.
I just had a conversation last night with a guy who is very similar to me, and I think you are too, in that we've got this. We're not employee men. Okay, you know, we're not very good at being employees, namely because we don't like working for people that are dumber than us. And we require independence and the ability to create and make things that don't currently exist. Employment opportunities in that regard, with an employer who respects you, who's smarter than you, and can allow you all of those freedoms, they're extremely rare. And most people like us, either A1, they decide to keep working in a slave job for their entire life, and then when they die, they have a list of regrets. Or two, they destroy their life in order to become independent and then build themselves back up from scratch again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the manager that you mentioned that's, you know, really smart and can deal with people and you really respect, it's kind of like finding a two-headed unicorn in some ways. And but the interesting thing I've noticed is there's, you know, I've in technology, you can't help but work with a lot of supposedly intelligent people. And what happens is a lot of them, you know, they know that they're work slaves. It doesn't take a genius to realize when you're in a cube, you've just, you know, changed from one kind of prison bars to the other. But they realize it. But there's a little bit of this sort of denial complex that people get where, you know, it seems like everybody else is doing this, so it can't be that bad, right? And so they kind of stay in that grind. And then you realize a little bit when you're older, hey, wait a minute, I've been working, you know, 70 hours a week for how many years and barely taking vacations. And, you know, and geez, my financial manager tells me I'm going to have to work for another 70 years before I can retire. Guess what? There is no retirement, man. You know, so it's
what they call the ladder climbing. And people are foolish. They believe people who are more powerful than them, believing that authority can be trusted. And this is a bad idea. What did I say? Business is like politics. Foolish people think that they can change that system, that company, that country, etc., from within. This is the big lie.
Right.
This is how they attract good apples and force them into the bad barrel.
There was this fantastic quote from my favorite comedian, the late Bill Hicks. I hope people know who Bill Hicks is.
He's my favorite, too. In fact, he was probably my broad base awakening to becoming a truther in the first place when I was at university all those years ago.
Wow, man, what a coincidence that is, huh? He, you know, he said something, it was this big long spiel, but at the end he said, you know, people, the reason why the systems around us are failing us is because they're no longer relevant. You know, evolution did not stop when we acquired opposable thumbs. You know that, right? And I really, the impact of that statement is, it's, there's so much analysis of that in one comic routine, right? Where, and it's just what you said, people are fighting, like another Buckminster quote about, you don't change things fighting the existing reality. You change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And that's exactly what a lot of these alternative socioeconomic paradigms that I've been looking into are doing. And it's what we did in open source. It's to some extent what crowdfunding is about. And going forward, I think the real new, you know, I wrote the series New Face of Venture Capital. The new face of activism, I think, is exactly obeying the thinking, at least letting it resonate with you, what you said, that, you know, let's not get inside and try to change stuff. It's like trying to change somebody. You know, like trying to change a person. You know, my mom told me when I was younger, you'll never teach anyone anything. They can only learn it. And, you know, trying to change somebody is sort of like that. It's like pushing up against a brick wall. And so I'm really happy when people just finally get so disgusted trying to change stuff that they think, hey, well, let's just create something else, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a lot to talk about that in this conversation about, you know, upcoming models and what, you know, what we can do in activism and so forth.
Mm. It's like freaking Sinatra. I did it my way.
You have to, there's a certain personality trait that helps you kind of be that way too, right? Where, like, I think I was born iconoclastic, you know, I think there's a button and I have to go push it. And, you know, if somebody's all kind of, you know, arrogant about, you know, look at me, I'm, you know, I'm a manager, I'm running something, it's almost like you want to go up and kind of poke him in the eye just for being a douche. And so
I think the curse is being intelligent enough to realize how stupid everyone else is.
There's some truth in that, man. But, you know, it's interesting, part of my sense of activism anyway is I've found as many ways as possible that did not work activating people just by accident, like trying this, trying that, and realizing none of this crap's working, right? And I created this phrase, I call it thought bomb. You know, it's like if someone's in a foxhole, right, and you're shooting bullets over their head, they'll just duck and they'll entrench in their foxhole even deeper. they're not coming out, man. Those bullets whizzing over, you can talk about chemtrails or banksters or whatever, right? GMO food. It's just like more bullets over them. But you throw a thought grenade in their foxhole, they're coming out. And sometimes, you know, it's not just about intellect, but that the way that someone's being approached doesn't flush them out. You have to really, really give someone a reason to jump out of their foxhole. And so I think some of the people who are kind of outside the system have to think with higher leverage in terms of activating people.
And we considering activation, I don't think that it's possible to do it kind of like this gently approach that people are talking about, you know, like, oh, right, you've got to present the information in a way that's acceptable and palatable and blah, 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 blah. Dude, I'm not the mainstream media, okay? I am going to destroy your brain by giving you a bullet of information to the head, and it will take you a long time to heal from that injury. Same as everybody else, it's not pleasant.
Sorry, man, but I just JFK'd the old you.
Yeah,
absolutely, man. That's how it's got to be done. And it seems almost cruel at some levels, but it's even crueler letting somebody, in my opinion, live in an old paradigm that's going to end in their demise anyway. And so I've started to explore and find ways that are a lot better at activating. Like, for example, I was at a local town meeting here around the Mountain View area. I'm in Silicon Valley, or Silicon Valley, as I like to call it, for those who don't know the area. And, there were some people talking about how, the zoning commission's going to, like, ban living in these zones, and they're going to make public transit down this big corridor. You know, this El Camino Real is going to be converted to, like, I don't know, the Grand something or other. And it just rings of Agenda 21 kind of stuff. And so I'm listening to them, and they're like, yeah, let's get together and have a neighborhood meeting. And I go there, and they're all talking about it, and no one has a clue what's going on. And I said, I just want to check. Do you guys know about Agenda 21? Because that's what's going on here. And they're like, Agenda 21, what's that? You know? And I said, well, here's the deal. You know, you should learn about it, and it'll explain what's going on. Of course, none of that worked, right? People aren't going to go learning about anything. It's like, well, hey, I don't know that. It must not be that. If I didn't hear it in, Fox News or CNN, it can't be that important.
I love that. If I haven't heard about it before, it doesn't exist. Like,
yeah,
bro, yeah. When was the last time you learned something new in your life? Well, I'm sorry. We're coming to break right now. Kevin, we'll be right back, folks. This episode is sponsored by Blue Shield, but also, more specifically, Kevin's novel, which you can purchase off the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, The Crowdfunding Revolution. Check it out, and we'll be right back.
It's Peace Train, holy roller. Everyone jump up on the Peace Train.
What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and follow my face on somebody's new mowed lawn. I've been having a sweet dream.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My very special guest is still author Kevin Lawton, the author of The Crowdfunding Revolution at thecrowdfundingrevolution.com. You can see a link to his book on the homepage, thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Bear in mind, we do take now a little bit of advertising revenue, so if you have a small business or a book or something like that you want to promote, just approach me, throw some money at me, just like everybody else. So yeah, this show is still, by the way, vastly, mostly funded just by listener subscriptions and donations. So don't think because we've got a few little banners and ads on the website that it's capable of paying for rent, power, fuel, and everything else that you need to do to pay for to expose scumbaggery and attend protests and interview people and all of that kind of stuff. It's just not enough. And we would love to have resources, you know, so you can help people. There's two types of people that try to accumulate resources. One that try to accumulate it all for themselves so that they can help only themselves. And the others who try to accumulate resources for themselves so that they can help other people. Okay? I'm the latter. Believe me. And if you don't believe me, I can show you lots of evidence. Interviews for years and years and years. It'll literally take you at least 2 years solid of viewing exclusively my content before you could get through half of it. I'm not kidding. There's that much. I've done a lot of work and helped a lot of people get their word out. So if you want to help me continue to do that, please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and click donate or subscribe for a couple of dollars a month, whether through PayPal or preferably the Kiwi Bank, because PayPal takes a percentage. Kevin, welcome back.
All right, man. It's good to be back.
Now, where were we when we just broke off that last segment there?
I was talking about the situation that some people from local community were trying to, you know, trying to kind of push back against some development plans that sound a lot like Agenda 21 and activism, and how, you know, people tend to like to think that, hey, if I haven't heard about it before, it can't be that important. And I realized after the fact, instead of informing people with just a, you know, kind of general bullet points on a you know, PowerPoint presentation type of thing, even though it was really just verbal, I realized, you know, there are a lot better ways to kind of shake people loose of their thinking. And so then I realized, you know, next time I have a meeting, I think I'm going to hire a couple guys dress up in bankster suits and with sunglasses, the whole lot, and just show up and quietly mill around. People will be like really suspicious. Who are these people?
I like that. I have a bankster suit and sunglasses.
Yeah, man, that'd be great. You know, if you're out this way, let's get you activating, man. Because I was thinking we could tell them, hey, look, if someone asks you, what are you guys doing here? You know, you say, you know, let's just say that we represent the banking industry and we want to see how easy it is going to be to take your land. and then quietly, after stirring around and then just saying a few things, just quietly leave. And then what will happen is people will be, you know, the thing is, honestly, when groups of people get together, you know, we could call it activism. I think a lot of it's voyeurism. I think people just like to be around other people talking about something happening, yeah. You know, and, you know, it's, and honestly, activism is really reactivism. People are just reacting to stuff anyway. And so
there's the two elements here. There's activism and entrepreneurism. One kind of holds back the progress of those who want to hold back the entrepreneurs, and one creates new stuff for the activists to oppose.
There's a lot of dynamics going on, and that might even segue in a little bit into you know, my thoughts about crowdfunding and venture capital and a lot of the, I like to go and dispel a lot of belief systems. One of them is venture capital and why that's supposedly so fantastic. And I mean, we could talk about a lot of stuff, but that's a great segue into that, actually.
Well, by all means, regale me.
So in a lot of ways, when I talked about the Securities Act in 3334, kind of boxing people out, creating this apartheid system, really what that did when regular people couldn't fund each other for their small businesses and whatnot was, would it put the control into the hands of a few people who could acquire pools of money. Venture guys generally, they just actually get their money from somebody else. They're an indirect investor, so they get money from insurance trusts and CalPERS, you know, these kind of retirement funds, whatnot. And so because they're, you know, considered accredited investors or people with their own net worth or accredited investors, then it really consolidated down into fewer and fewer hands. And then the venture capital industry really blossomed because there was nothing else. I mean, banks don't lend money to high volatility, seed stage funded startup companies. It's just not what they do. You know, revenue, no product, no clue. So essentially, the venture capital industry is a byproduct in a lot of way a lot of ways off of the suppression that happened in the early 30s in the U.S. and a little bit later in other countries. And you have, you know, you have these people, these MBAs and spreadsheet jockeys and all that wearing suits. I call them circus monkeys, but we'll call them venture capitalists. And they, you know, run around being self-important and drive their hot cars and stuff like that. The end of the day, these guys are the least venturesome people on earth. They are nothing but cherry pickers. Angel investors are a little bit better, but venture capitalists, the way they really work these days, they used to do a little bit more aggressive investing, but they pretty much run around waiting until a deal is obvious. They got a whole bunch of users or some lineup of products, revenue, what have you, a lot of traction, as they like to say. And they find ones that are so obvious that they just all pile in and try to be the one to invest in that particular deal. And I mean, just to kind of, you know, to sort of summarize things here, obviously we're putting everybody in a bucket, but, and at the end of the day, only a few percent of the venture capital firms really make outsized returns. A lot of them make very little, nothing, or a lot of them lose money. They're really an awful investment for most of the limited partners. And when you talk to these guys, you realize really quickly that there's nothing about venture and venture capital. It's all about cherry picking. So that my favorite cherry picking analogy is like, if there's a tree, a lot of cherries, luscious cherries dangling off, people come and they pick the bottom layers, and then maybe they stretch out a little bit to pick the upper layers. But the ones at the top, the people with the tall step ladders get to them. And that's really just the brand affinity that a lot of these, you know, famous venture capitalists have. They have a network and they're the go-to VCs because, hey, you know, everyone else knows that Sequoia is a great venture capital firm, blah, blah, blah. That's the stepladder, man. Other than that, venture capital is really, really not a good model. And I'll go into that a lot, actually, as much as you guys like to hear, because it's really important for people to understand that while people are worshiping these guys, there's an entire cult of entrepreneurs who just worship the brand name venture capitalist. It's really not a good model. And one of my favorite points to make, and this really will be a great segue later in the crowdfunding, is this. If you want to find those big outlier ideas that turn into the next Google, Facebook, or whatever, Tesla electric car, what have you, you need access to a huge amount of data points, meaning a lot of potential deals. So you need an enormous volume of potential deals and then an ability to sift through those deals. And I just boil it down to call it synthesis. You need synthesis. That's what a large crowd does. And if we look to how the crowd has done synthesis at finding outliers or predicting outcomes across the board, like predicting what the box office receipts or the presidential election or, you know, some weather event or whatever, internally at companies they call decision markets. They use what are called a prediction market externally, but internally a decision market to use the entire knowledge base of all the employees in a company to actually predict an outcome or make a decision. And it turns out time after time that these mechanisms surpass the ability of any expert panel or any hierarchy of management to make decisions or predict outcomes. Every time, by big margins, like they're 90-something% accurate. They even predict at Innocentive did a great study. There's a company that does a sort of crowdsourced decision market. They have a thing where they realized in pharmaceutical companies, when they're going through the various stages of trials, that the employees could actually predict which drugs would go from one stage to the next, whereas the management had the worst time predicting. And so that same mechanism is exactly what crowdfunding is. It's a giant synthesis market with huge amounts of input and a lot of sorting capacity. And by the way, nothing democratic about the synthesis. And that's the important part. You need to really identify outliers. You need outlier identifiers. So you need to weight people's decisions based on their, for example, their past ability to predict something, predict an event, or to be able to solve a problem. you have it's an true. Enormous...
You need outliers, but also you need to kick out actual liars from your
family. Yeah, and you can find those with outliers. That's the beauty, is you can find charlatans. And it was interesting. I go to these crowdfunding conferences, and people are talking about regulation. You know, we got to protect the people, right? One of the biggest mind screws ever.
I love that. You know, in fact, that reminds me, I just saw a Morgan Freeman post that is brilliant. Let me see if I've got this correct. You believe people can't govern themselves, but you believe some people can govern hundreds of millions of other people?
That's kind of like in, I think it was 1984, the Orwell book, where there was that saying on the barn, you know, all animals are created equal, but some animals are created more equal.
Animal Farm.
Animal Farm.
Written by George Orwell, who also wrote 1984.
Yeah, that's sort of in the same vein, man. And actually, that's basically, you could say that about venture capitalists. You know, they're the... you know, the slightly smarter or better animals or more equal animals.
I love it how they have the same letter starting it as vulture capitalists. That you can't make the stuff up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of people call them that. I like to call them circus monkeys, but I hate to, you know, say bad things about vultures. But actually,
do you know why vultures never have much luggage when they go on commercial flights?
Why is that, man?
Because they prefer carrion.
Jesus. You just come up with this stuff real time, huh?
Yeah.
So,
it's an incredibly worthless skill. Like, you know how some people are really good at something that is absolutely useless?
Like remembering the trivia tidbits and whatnot?
Yeah.
Hey.
Spend your entire life doing this. I'm sorry. I'm going to shut up now. Continue.
No, it's probably why you're still sane, though, at the end of the day. So I'm sure there's a lot of use to it.
Well, you got to laugh at the insanity. Otherwise, you join it.
Absolutely, man. I was at a, they have these panels, so they have these networking events around here, and they had a panel of venture capitalists and maybe an angel investor on stage, you know, talking whatever smack about the industry, and they got to the Q&A, and I'm like your worst nightmare if you give me the microphone. I'm always the guy at every conference asking the, you know, the one-inch punch questions that no one want to get hit with, and so I get up. And I ask, said, you know, you guys are in the business of financing innovation. Can you tell me the last innovation in venture capitalism? And there was this large, uncomfortable pause in the room. Like no one said anything. And then one guy, I think he was an angel actually, sheepishly admitted, well, we're really not that innovative of a kind of people. So, I'm not sure how I got into that, but anyway, that was a nice little story to give you an idea that we've got people, vulture capitalists, you know, funding people without having a clue about how to innovate in their own field, you know.
Mm. Well, I think this is actually brings upon an important point. My former producer once told me that people bring three elements to the deal: talent, resources, or capital. Would you agree with that?
Well, those are three components you can bring to a deal for sure. Hopefully people bring, you know, some other components, right? Some people bring their sort of, I guess you could call it a resource, but they're sort of their network. And some people are good at, ideating and shaping ideas, and some good at marketing and graphics design and all these kind of things. But it's a general rule. That's sort of a good place to start, what you mentioned. And at some point too, we could get into, I have some pretty interesting thoughts on Bitcoin and money and some other things like credibility networks that very few people are really talking about out there. So whenever you'd like, we can kind of vector into some of those topics.
By all means, proceed.
Yeah. So Bitcoin and the whole alt currency space, obviously that's really exploded over the last year. And, you know, I fear that people have got kind of roped into a really poor design, a really kind of there's an element of Bitcoin and friends that is really good in the sense that it inspires people to think there's something else. And so for that, I give it an enormous amount of credit. It's just that I hate when people vector their energy into something new and it's kind of just as crappy or nearly as crappy as where they came from. And that's the way I feel about Bitcoin. So one of my big issues about this whole Bitcoin situation is, or all these altcoins really, is if you think about money in general, one of the big problems in my opinion is money is we have this thing I call dynasty. And that is the people that were in the system before who were able to lever it and, you know, use it to their advantage, they accumulated more money. They accumulated this dynasty, the ability to use that money to then get more money, you know, whether they're investors or what have you. And you could think about it as money or resources or whatever. And then it comes along a young generation that starts out with nothing. In fact, they start out in debt, you know, Visa cards and student bills and all these kinds of things, really indentured servants. And they have the opposite of dynasty, right? They have no leverage whatsoever, even though they probably have the most capacity to generate something interesting in the future. And so they're starting out negative money. And in a lot of ways, that accumulation of dynasty leads to more accumulation of it, because once people have it, they just can't get enough of it, and at least a lot of people in that position. And so then they use it to their advantage, and they go around and do things like buy up politicians and other kind of, you know, other kinds of peoples, other police judge or what have you. And they do more and more sketchy things to accumulate more dynasty. So then they, in a relative scale, the common people have less and less. And we have unfortunately got caught in a system where we worship fake, you know, electronic digits these days in some bank account of some person who accumulated these digits from somebody else, generally through some form of usury. And it's really an unfortunate model. And then what we did with Bitcoin and friends is we recreated that. It's just a different set of people have the digits. And actually, there's only some gamers and people like this accumulated Bitcoin early. Good for them. I don't have any problem with that. But honestly, there's a lot of rich people now that own a big chunks of Bitcoin. And so you have actually really 100, 200 people who own a good chunk of Bitcoin. That's dynasty already, and it's fairly young as an idea. And then it turns out that the amount, there's only 10 or 20 exchanges of Bitcoin that really handle most of the traffic, and the same for the people that are mining, big companies that are doing the mining. So you have hardware dynasty, exchange dynasty, and currency dynasty all in one within just a small amount of years. And, I'd really like to send the message out to people that if someone really wants to create the currency of the future, then make a currency so it's people-sourced, so that by virtue of being alive, you actually get allocated units of currency. And on top of that, not on a basis of one time. I mean, there was a Spanish coin and a currency in Iceland they tried to do this with, where they did a one-time allocation across everybody who was essentially a citizen. That sounds great, but then what happens for the people who were born right after that? They're locked into this feudalism or this serfdom because some people before them have this dynasty. So if we really want to honor the rights of people, we have to make the money creation continuous and into everybody. Source people as the way of creating money rather than lending it through a bank. And then let people spend and invest it. And I've got a blog post on thecrowdfundingrevolution.com about this kind of new model. I'm interested in talking with anybody who would like to actually do it. I don't have the time myself, but I think this would be a more interesting model that would be a great stepping stone between where we are and where we could go, such that we would actually honor people's existence instead of starting off as a feudal slave. So that's a kind of overview of some of the critiques I have. Obviously, there are other issues like Bitcoin has a fairly lengthy sign-off time. And what that does is the following. If you're doing an exchange online through Bitcoin, generally a lot of vendors, they're really taking the Bitcoin and doing an exchange, maybe using BitPay or other, to go from Bitcoin to cash. And in a long, even if you wait 15, 20 minutes to sign off, what that does is that actually maps into volatility of the price, which has to get absorbed by the people doing the crossing the currency grid. as a fee, essentially. So by way of having a long sign-off time, you end up jacking up the fee, essentially. And then it sort of moots some of the point about how Bitcoin's better than some of the other payment services because of lower fees and whatnot. So, you know, there's some issues there. And then Bitcoin itself has a problem where people are mining it on special purpose processors, essentially. And what that does is it means that you need quite a bit of money to get a current device to be able to mine competitively. And in fact, every month you need to go throw that away or sell it on eBay and get a different one. And it becomes a hardware arms race. And what happens is fewer and fewer people are able to keep up with the arms race. And so at the end, guess what? A few people own most of the mining equipment.
Yeah, and not to mention the banks own both sides of all of those operations anyway, because Absolutely. They couldn't have even started those operations without the vulture capitalists from the international banks who can make money out of thin air to process in the first place.
Absolutely, man. And then you think about it, if you're a bankster and you can print money out of thin air at will, you could just pretty much mop up. You could just, distort, smack down, smack up the price of whatever these alt currencies are. They're tiny. The total market cap of all the alt currencies, I think, is $20 billion or something like that. I mean, you could just mop up whatever you wanted and own a big chunk and then swing the price around. You know, you could just send it into oblivion, making people pay big fees with the volatility and so forth. So it's really not a good model. It's not a well-thought-out model. It's not that I blame somebody, because they probably weren't even thinking about really doing it, using it on a wide scale like it is today. But I'm just making the point that don't get stuck in thinking that Bitcoin is the ultimate future. It's not. It's not even close. And it's that, it has a public ledger. Police have said they love Bitcoin because it leaves such a forensic trail that it makes it easy for them to trace money, whereas cash is hard to trace. So don't get wrapped up in that kind of thinking. There are far better models, and I hope that people investigate some of them.
See, I've always avoided Bitcoin and what have you. I'm just using PayPal at the moment, and they're kind of like perhaps an evil scum corporations or whatever. But I'm a fan of, if you can use an evil person's resources to accomplish good ends, then it's all right.
Hey, yeah, God's truth is still truth, man, everywhere it goes. So absolutely, use whatever you've got.
Yeah, I mean, like if you were to break the law and let's say, I don't know, hack into David Rockefeller's personal checking account and steal $100 million, and then you give that $100 million to, let's say, 100 different conspiracy theorists who have already got really good radio shows and YouTube channels and so on, and they go, here you go, guys, here's a boost, you're all Rockefeller funded now. Would everybody refuse the money?
Yeah, I hate to encourage that publicly, but it's an interesting idea. Yeah, I hear you, man. I mean, I think there's a real problem I have with purism. So many people get wrapped up with trying to stay completely pure and then end up being completely ineffective. Right, I mean, it's.
Oh my God! You just described half the conspiracy movement, bro.
Yeah, unfortunately, but you know what? At the end of the day, I think a lot of, isn't it the case in history, and I hope going forward anyway, that a lot of the real meaningful movements and things that have been done in the world are done by small groups of people, and so there are a lot of people that are just along for the ride or really, kind of wrapped up in their own little thought bubble they got going on. It doesn't really matter that much, I mean, some people do get kind of a little too purist in the activism category. But it's for, here's my great analogy. People, we all love to, myself included, berate the sheeple of the world. But at the end of the day, I think that, it's good, clean fun, right? The sheeple are probably going to be the shining light in the end. And here's the reason I say it. Because, think, if guys like us are sheepdogs and there's a herd of sheep, and on the other side is these wolves, right? They're the banksters and all these kind of bad guys. The sheep, they're they're just cheap, man. They're going to do what sheep will do. And the real strategy here is in the minds of the sheepdogs, right? If the sheepdogs activate the flock in the right direction, man, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what's going on with those wolves. They're going to get run over. And so, like, sometimes I think that the real problem with activizing people is really in the minds of the few people who actually are kind of have enough perspective to see the bigger picture, but are not using high leverage to activate people. They're not doing the right kind of activism. They're making all the mistakes I did over the years of, you know, trying to tell people the truth and information and, you know, all these kind of rude things.
I love those naive mistakes. I'll go out and tell people the truth and they'll believe me because it's true.
Yeah.
Where did I
get that idea?
I thought the universe had justice and logic and reason. Oh, wait, no, actually, it's completely mad. And that old adage that in an insane world, a sane man must appear insane is certainly true. Kevin Lawton, the author of The Crowdfunding Revolution, links to the book on the homepage of thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. There also his website, thecrowdfundingrevolution.com. We'll be right back.